where he was, and then was going to come to the home and eat him, like it ate the little animals. So he pretty much made up his mind not to get real close to it again, stay far away. But now, he couldn't do that because of Julie and the baby. If Bobby, who never worried, was so worried for Julie, then Thomas needed to be even more worried for her than he was. And if Julie and Bobby thought the baby should be watched over, then Thomas had to worry about the baby too, because what was important to Julie was important to him. He reached out into the day. It was there, far away yet. He didn't get close. He was scared. But for Julie, for Bobby, for the baby, he'd have to stop being scared, get closer, and be sure he knew all the time where the bad thing was and whether it was coming this way.
Jackie Jacks did not arrive at the offices of Dakota & Dakota until 4:10 that Tuesday afternoon. A full hour after Bobby and Clint returned, and to Julie's annoyance, he spent half an hour creating an atmosphere that he found conducive to his work. He felt the room was too bright, so he closed the blinds and the large windows, though the approaching winter twilight and an incoming bank of clouds over the Pacific had already robbed the day of much of its light. He tried different arrangements with the three brass lamps, each of which was equipped with a three-way bulb, giving him what seemed an infinite number of combinations. He finally left one of them at 70 watts, one at 30, and one off completely. He asked Frank to move from the sofa to one of the chairs, decided that wasn't going to work, moved Julie's big chair out from behind the desk and put him in that, then arranged four other chairs in a semicircle in front of it. Julie suspected that Jackie could have worked effectively with the blinds open and all of the lamps on. He was a performer, however, even when off the stage, and he could not resist being theatrical. In recent years, magicians had forsaken fake showbiz monikers like the Great Blackwell and Harry Houdini in favor of names that at least seemed like real ones. But Jackie was a throwback. Just as Houdini's real name was Eric Weiss, so Jackie had been baptized David Carver. Because he performed comic magic, he had avoided mysterious-sounding names. And because since puberty he had yearned to be part of the nightclub and Vegas scene, he had chosen a new identity that, to him and those in his social circle, sounded like Nevada royalty. While other kids thought about being teachers, doctors, real estate salesmen, or auto mechanics, young Davy Carver had dreamed of being someone like Jackie Jacks. Now, God help him, he was living his dream. Although he was currently between a one-week engagement in Reno and a stint as the opening act for Sammy Davis in Vegas, Jackie showed up not in blue jeans or an ordinary suit, but in an outfit he could have worn during performances, a black leisure suit with emerald green piping on the lapels and cuffs of the jacket, a matching green shirt and black patent leather shoes. He was 36 years old, 5'8", thin, cancerously tanned, with hair that he dyed ink black, and teeth that were unnaturally, ferociously white, thanks to the modern miracle of dental bonding. 3 years ago, Dakota and Dakota had been hired by the Las Vegas hotel with which Jackie had a long-term contract, and charged with the sticky task of uncovering the identity of a blackmailer who was trying to extort most of the magician's income. The case had had many unexpected twists and turns, but by the time they reached the end, the thing that most surprised Julie was that she had gotten over her initial distaste for the magician and had come to sort of like him. Sort of. Finally, Jackie settled on the chair directly in front of Frank. "Julie, you and Clint sit to my right, Bobby to my left, please." Julie saw no good reason why she couldn't sit in whichever of the three chairs she chose, but she played along. Half of Jackie's Vegas act involved the hypnotizing and comic exploitation of audience members. His knowledge of hypnotic technique was so extensive, and his understanding of the functioning of the mind in a trance state was so profound, that he was frequently invited to participate in medical conferences with physicians, psychologists, and psychiatrists who were exploring practical uses of hypnosis. Perhaps they could have persuaded a psychiatrist to help them pierce Frank's amnesia with hypnotic regression therapy. But it was doubtful that any doctor was as qualified for the task as Jackie Jacks. Besides, no matter what fantastic things Jackie learned about Frank, he could be counted on to keep his mouth shut. He owed a lot to Bobby and Julie. And in spite of his faults, he was a man who paid his debts, and at least had a vestigial sense of loyalty that was rare in the me-me-me culture of show business. In the moody amber light of the two brass lamps, with the world darkening rapidly beyond the drawn blinds, Jackie's smooth and well-projected voice, full of low, rounded tones and an occasional dramatic vibrato, commanded not just Frank's attention, but everyone else's as well. He used a beveled teardrop crystal on a gold chain to focus Frank's attention, after suggesting that the others look at Frank's face rather than at the bauble to avoid unwanted entrancement. "Frank, please watch the light winking in the crystal, a very soft and lovely light fluttering from one facet to another, a very warm and appealing light, warm, fluttering." After a while, lulled somewhat herself by Jackie's calculated patter, Julie noticed Frank's eyes glaze over. Beside her, Clint switched on the small tape recorder that he had used when Frank had told them his story yesterday afternoon. Still twisting the chain back and forth between his thumb and forefinger to make the crystal spin on the end of the jack, he said, "All right, Frank, you are now slipping into a very relaxed state, a deeply relaxed state, where you will hear only my voice, no other, and will respond only to my voice, no other." When he had conveyed Frank into a deep trance and finished giving him instructions related to the interrogation ahead, Jackie told him to close his eyes. Frank obliged. Jackie put the crystal down. He said, "What is your name?" "Frank Pollard." "Where do you live?" "I don't know." Having been briefed on the phone by Julie earlier in the day, aware of the information they were seeking from their client, Jackie said, "Have you ever lived in El Encanto?" A hesitation. Then, "Yes." Frank's voice was strangely flat. His face was so haggard and deathly pale that he seemed almost like an exhumed corpse that had been sorcerously revitalized for the purpose of serving as a bridge between the members of a seance and those to whom they wished to speak in the land of the dead. "Do you recall your address in El Encanto?"
"No."
"Was your address 1458 Pacific Hill Road?" A frown flickered across Frank's face and was gone almost as soon as it came.
"Yes, that's what Bobby found with the computer."
"But do you actually remember that place?"
"No."
Jackie adjusted his Rolex watch, then used both hands to smooth back his thick black hair. "When did you live in El Encanto, Frank?"
"I don't know."
"You must tell me the truth."
"Yeah."
"You cannot lie to me, Frank, or hide anything from me. That is impossible in your current state. When did you live there?"
"I don't know."
"Did you live there alone?"
"I don't know."
"Do you remember being in the hospital last night, Frank?"
"Yeah."
"And you disappeared?"
"They say I did."
"Where did you disappear to, Frank?" Silence. Frank, where did you disappear to?
I'm afraid.
Why?
I don't know. I can't think.
Frank, do you remember waking up in your car last Thursday morning parked along a street in Laguna Beach?
Yeah.
Your hands were full of black sand?
Yeah.
Frank wiped his hands on his thighs, as if he could feel the black grains clinging to his sweaty palms. Where did you get that sand, Frank?
I don't know.
Take your time. Think about it.
I don't know.
Do you remember checking into a motel later, napping, then waking up with blood all over yourself?
I remember,
Frank said, and he shuddered. Where did that blood come from, Frank?
I don't know, he said miserably.
It was cat blood, Frank. Did you know it was cat blood?
No.
His eyelids fluttered, but he did not open his eyes.
Just cat blood? Really?
Do you remember encountering a cat that day?
No.
Clearly, a more aggressive technique would be required to get the answers they needed. Jackie began to talk Frank backward in time, gradually regressing him to his admission to the hospital yesterday evening. Then, farther back toward the moment he had awakened in that Anaheim alleyway in the earliest hours of Thursday morning, knowing nothing but his name. Beyond that point might lie his memory if he could be induced to step through the veil of amnesia and recover his past. Julie leaned slightly forward in her chair and looked past Jackie Jacks, wondering how Bobby was enjoying the show. She figured the spinning crystal and other hocus-pocus would appeal to his boyish spirit of adventure and that he would be smiling and bright-eyed. Instead, he was somber. His teeth must have been clenched, for his jaw muscles bulged. He had told her what they'd learned at Dyson Manford's house, and she had been as astonished and shaken as he and Clint. But that didn't seem to explain his current mood. Maybe he was still unnerved by the memory of the bugs in the entomologist's study. Or maybe he continued to be troubled by that dream he'd had last week. The bad thing is coming. The bad thing. She had dismissed his dream as unimportant. Now she wondered if it had been genuinely prophetic. After all the weirdness that Frank had brought into their lives, she was more willing to give credence to such things as omens, visions, and prescient dreams. The bad thing is coming. The bad thing. Maybe the bad thing was Mr. Blue. Jackie regressed Frank to the alleyway, to the very moment when he had first awakened in a strange place, disoriented and confused. Now go back further, Frank. Just a little further back, just a few more seconds, and a few more back, beyond the total darkness in your mind, beyond that black wall in your mind. Since the questioning had begun, Frank had appeared to dwindle in Julie's desk chair, as if made of wax and subjected to a flame. He had grown paler, too, if that was possible, as white as candle paraffin. But now, as he was forced backward through the darkness in his mind, toward the light of memory on the other side, he sat up straighter, put his hands on the arms of the chair, and clutched the vinyl almost tightly enough to cause the upholstery to split. He seemed to be growing, returning to his former size, as if he had drunk one of the magic elixirs that Alice had consumed in her adventures at the far end of the rabbit hole. "Where are you now?" Jackie asked. Frank's eyes twitched beneath his closed lids. An inarticulate, strangled sound issued from him. Where are you now? Jackie insisted gently but firmly. Fireflies, Frank said shakily. Fireflies in a windstorm. He began to breathe rapidly, raggedly, as if he were having trouble drawing air into his lungs. What do you mean by that, Frank? Fireflies. Where are you, Frank? Everywhere. Nowhere. We don't have fireflies in Southern California, Frank. So you must be somewhere else. Think, Frank. Look around yourself now and tell me where you are. Nowhere. Jackie made a few more attempts to get Frank to describe his surroundings and to be more specific as to the nature of the fireflies. All to no avail. Move him on from there, Bobby said. Farther back. Julie glanced at the recorder in Clint's hand and saw the spools turning behind the plastic window on the tape deck. With his melodic and vibrant voice in seductively rhythmic cadences, Jackie ordered Frank to regress past the firefly-speckled darkness. Suddenly, Frank said, What am I doing here? He was not referring to the offices of Dakota and Dakota, but to the place that Jackie Jacks had drawn him to in his memory. Why here? Where are you, Frank? The house. What in the hell am I doing here? Why did I come here? This is crazy. I shouldn't be here. Whose house is it, Frank? Bobby asked. Because he had been instructed to hear only the hypnotist's voice, Frank did not respond until Jackie repeated the question. Then, her house. It's her house. She's dead, of course, been dead 7 years, but it's still her house. Always will be. The bitch will haunt the place. You can't destroy that kind of evil. Not entirely. Part of it lingers in the rooms where she lived and everything she touched. Who was she, Frank?
Mother.
Your mother? What was her name?
Roselle. Roselle Pollard.
This is the house on Pacific Hill Road?
Yeah. Look at it. My God, what a place. What a dark place. What a bad place. Can't people see what a bad place it is? Can't they see that something terrible lives in there?
He was crying. Tears glimmered in his eyes, then streamed down his cheeks. Anguish twisted his voice.
Can't they see what's in there? What lives there? What hides there and breeds in that bad place? Are people blind? Or do they just not want to see?
Julie was riveted by Frank's tortured voice and by the agony that had wrenched his face into an approximation of the pained countenance of a lost and frightened child. But she turned away from him and peered past the hypnotist to see if Bobby had reacted to the words, bad place. He was looking at her. The expression of distress that darkened his blue eyes was proof enough that the reference had not escaped him. At the other end of the room, carrying a sheaf of printouts, Lee Chen entered from the reception lounge. He closed the door quietly. Julie put a finger to her lips, then motioned him to the sofa. Jackie spoke soothingly to Frank, trying to allay the fear that had electrified him. Suddenly, Frank let out a sharp cry of fear. He sounded more like a frightened animal than like a man. He sat up even straighter. He was trembling. He opened his eyes, but obviously did not see anything in the room. He was still in a trance.
Oh, my God! He's coming! He's coming now! The twins must have told him I'm here. He's coming!
Frank's unalloyed terror was so pure and intense that some of it was communicated to Julie. Her heartbeat speeded up, and she began to breathe more rapidly, shallowly. Trying to keep his subject relaxed enough to be cooperative, Jackie said, "Calm down, Frank. Relax and be calm. Nobody can hurt you. Nothing unpleasant will happen. Be calm, relaxed, calm." Frank shook his head.
No, he's coming, he's coming. He's going to get me this time. Damn it, why did I come back here? Why did I come back and give him a chance at me?
Relax now.
He's there.
Frank tried to rise to his feet, seemed unable to find the strength, and dug his fingers even deeper into the vinyl padding on the arms of the chair.
He's right there, and he sees me. He sees me.
Bobby said, "Who is he, Frank?" And Jackie repeated the question.
Candy. It's Candy.
When he was asked again for the name of this person he feared, he repeated,
Candy.
His name is Candy?
He sees me.
In a more forceful and commanding voice than before, Jackie said, You will relax, Frank. You will be calm and relaxed. But Frank only grew more agitated. He had broken into a sweat. Fixed on something in a far place and time. His eyes were wild. His terror seemed to be sweeping him into a heart-bursting panic.
I don't have much control of him, Jackie said worriedly. I'm going to have to bring him out of it.
Bobby slid forward to the edge of his chair.
No, not yet. In a minute, but not yet. Ask him about this Candy. Who is this guy?
Jackie repeated the question. Frank said,
He's death.
Frowning, Jackie said, That's not a clear answer, Frank.
He's death walking. He's death living. He's my brother, her child, her favorite child, her spawn. And I hate him. He wants to kill me. Here he comes.
With a wretched bleat of terror, Frank started to push up from the chair. Jackie ordered him to stay where he was. Frank sat down reluctantly, but his terror only grew because he could still see Candy coming toward him. Jackie tried to bring him out of that place in the past, forward to the present, and out of his trance, but to no avail.
Got to get away. Now,
Frank said desperately. Julie was frightened for him. She'd never seen anyone look more pathetic or vulnerable. He was drenched in sweat, shaking violently. His hair had fallen over his forehead into his eyes, but it did not interfere with the vision of terror that he had called up from his past. He clutched the arms of the chair so fiercely that a fingernail on his right hand finally punctured the vinyl upholstery.
I've got to get out of here,
Frank repeated urgently. Jackie told him to stay.
No, I've got to get away from him.
To Bobby, Jackie Jack said, This has never happened to me. I've lost control of him. Jesus, look at him. I'm afraid the guy's going to have a heart attack.
Come on, Jackie. You've got to help him,
Bobby said sharply. He got off his chair, squatted beside Frank, putting his hand on Frank's in a gesture of comfort and reassurance.
Bobby, don't, Clint said, standing up so fast that he dropped the tape recorder he'd been balancing on his thigh.
Bobby didn't respond to Clint, for he was too focused on Frank, who seemed to be shaking himself to pieces in front of them. The guy was like a boiler with a jammed release valve, filled to the bursting point, not with steam pressure, but with manic terror. Bobby was trying to calm him where Jackie had failed. For an instant, Julie didn't understand what had made Clint shoot to his feet. But she realized that Bobby had seen something the rest of them had missed. Fresh blood on Frank's right hand. Bobby hadn't put his hand over Frank's merely to offer comfort. He was trying, as gently as possible, to loosen Frank's grip on the arm of the chair because Frank had torn open the vinyl and cut himself, perhaps repeatedly, on an exposed staple or upholstery tack.
"He's coming. Got to get away."
Frank let go of the chair, grabbed Bobby's hand, and got to his feet, pulling Bobby up with him. Suddenly, Julie understood what Clint feared, and she stood up so fast that she knocked her chair over. "Bobby, no!" Thrown into a panic by the vision of his murderous brother, Frank screamed. With a hiss like steam escaping from a locomotive engine, he vanished and took Bobby with him. Fireflies in a windstorm. Bobby seemed to be floating in space, for he had no sense of his body's position. Couldn't tell if he was lying or sitting or standing, right side up or upside down, as if weightless in an immense void. He had no sense of smell or taste. He could hear nothing. He could feel neither heat nor cold, nor texture nor weight. The only thing he could see was limitless blackness that seemed to stretch to the ends of the universe, and millions upon millions of tiny fireflies, ephemeral as sparks, that swarmed around him. Actually, he was not sure he saw them at all, because he was not aware of having eyes with which to look at them. It was more as if he was aware of them, not through any of the usual senses, but through some inner sight, the mind's eye. At first he panicked. The extreme sensory deprivation convinced him that he was paralyzed, without feeling in any limb or inch of skin, felled by a massive cerebral hemorrhage, deafened and blinded and trapped forever in a damaged brain that had severed all its connections to the outside world. Then he became aware that he was in motion, not drifting in the blackness as he had first thought, but speeding through it, rocketing at a tremendous, frightening speed. He became aware of being drawn forward as if he were a bit of lint flying toward some vacuum cleaner of cosmic power, and all around him the fireflies swirled and tumbled. It was like being on an amusement park ride, so huge and fast that only God could have designed it for his own pleasure, though there was no pleasure whatsoever in it for Bobby as he roller-coastered through pitch blackness, trying to scream. He hit the forest floor on his feet, swayed, and almost fell against Frank, in front of whom he was standing. Frank still had a painfully tight grip on his hand. Bobby was desperate for air. His chest ached, his lungs seemed to have shriveled up. He sucked in a deep breath. Another, exhaling explosively. He saw the blood, which was on both of their hands now. An image of torn upholstery flashed through his mind. Jackie Jack's. Bobby remembered. When Bobby tried to pull loose of his client, Frank held him fast and said, "Not here. No, I can't risk this. Too dangerous. Why am I here?" Steeped in the scent of pines, Bobby surveyed the surrounding primeval forest, which was thick with shadows as dusk introduced night to the world. The air was frigid, and the bristling boughs of the giant evergreens drooped under a weight of snow, but he saw nothing frightening in that scene. Then he realized that Frank was staring past him. He turned to discover they were on the edge of the forest. A snow-covered meadow sloped up gently behind them. At the top was a log cabin, not a rustic shack, but an elaborate structure that clearly showed the input of an architect, a vacation retreat for someone with plenty of disposable income. A mantle of snow was draped over the main roof, another over the porch roof, each decorated with a fringe of icicles that glittered in the last beams of cold sunlight. No lights glowed at the windows, no smoke curled up from any of the three chimneys. The place appeared to be deserted.
"He knows about this," Frank said, still panicked. "I bought it under another name, but he found out about it, and he came here, almost killed me, and he's probably keeping tabs on it, checking in regularly, hoping to catch me again.
Bobby was less numbed by the sub-zero cold than by the realization that he had teleported out of their office and onto this slope in the Sierras or some other mountains. He finally found his voice and said,
Frank, what?
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. He hit the floor, rolling, slammed into a coffee table and felt Frank let go of his hand. The table crashed over, spilling a vase and other decorative and breakable items onto a hardwood floor. He'd sustained a solid knock to the head. When he pushed onto his knees and tried to stand, he was too dizzy to get up. Frank was already on his feet, looking around, breathing hard.
San Diego, this was my apartment once. He found out about it, had to get out fast.
When Frank reached down to help Bobby get up, Bobby unthinkingly accepted his hand, the uninjured one.
Someone else lives here now, Frank said. Must be off at work, we're lucky.
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. Bobby found himself standing at a rusted iron gate between two stone pilasters, looking at a Victorian-style house with a sagging porch roof, broken balusters, and sway-backed steps. The sidewalk was cracked and canted, and weeds flourished in an unmown lawn. In the gloaming, it looked like every kid's conception of a seriously haunted house, and he suspected it would look even worse in broad daylight. Frank gasped.
Jesus, no, not here.
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. Papers fluttered to the floor from a massive mahogany desk, as if a wind had swept through the room, though the air was still now. They were in a book-lined study with French windows. An old man had risen from a wing-backed leather chair. He was wearing gray flannel slacks, a white shirt, a blue cardigan, and a look of surprise. Frank said,
Doc!
And with his free hand reached toward the startled elder. Darkness. Bobby had figured out that all was lightless and featureless, because, for the moment, he did not exist as a coherent physical entity. He had no eyes, no ears, no nerve endings with which to feel, but understanding brought no diminishment of his fear. Fireflies. The millions of tiny, whirling points of light were probably the atomic particles of which his flesh was constructed, being shepherded along surely by the power of Frank's mind. Velocity. They were teleporting, and the process was probably just about instantaneous, requiring only microseconds from physical dissolution to reconstitution, though subjectively it seemed longer. The decrepit house again. It must be the place in the hills north of Santa Barbara. They were upslope from the gate along the Eugenia hedge that encircled the property. Frank let out a low cry of terror the instant that he saw where he was. Bobby was afraid of running into Kendi just as much as Frank was, but also afraid of Frank and of teleporting. Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. This time, they didn't materialize with the balance and stability of their arrival in the old man's study, or at the peeling house with the rusted gate, but with the clumsiness of their intrusion into that apartment in San Diego. Bobby stumbled a few steps up a slope, still in Frank's grip as firmly as if they had been handcuffed, and they both fell to their knees on the plush, well-cropped grass. Frantically, Bobby tried to wrench loose of Frank, but Frank held fast with superhuman strength and pointed to a gravestone only a few feet in front of them. Bobby looked around and saw that they were alone in a cemetery, where massive coral trees and palms loomed eerily in the purple-gray twilight.
"He was our neighbor," Frank said.
Gasping for breath, unable to speak, still twisting his hand in an attempt to escape Frank's iron grip, Bobby saw the name Norbert James Colreen in the granite headstone.
"She had him killed," Frank said. "Had her precious Kendi kill him just because she felt he'd been rude to her, Rude to her, the crazy bitch.
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. The book-lined study. The old man in the doorway now, looking into the room at them. Bobby felt as if he had been on a corkscrew roller coaster for hours, turning upside down at high speed again and again until he couldn't be sure anymore if he was actually moving or standing still, while the rest of the world spun and looped around him.
"I shouldn't have come here, Dr. Fogarty,"
Frank said worriedly. Blood dripped off his injured hand, spotting a pale green section of the Chinese carpet.
"Candy might have seen me at the house. Might be trying to follow. Don't want to lead him to you,"
Fogarty said.
"Frank, wait."
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. They were in the backyard of the decaying house, 30 or 40 feet from steps in a porch that were as spavined and dilapidated as those at the front of the place. Light shone in the first-floor windows.
"I want to go. I want to be out of here," Frank said.
Bobby expected the teleport at once and steeled himself for it, but nothing happened.
"I want out of here," Frank said again.
When they did not pop from that place to another, Frank cursed in frustration. Suddenly, the kitchen door opened, and a woman stepped into sight. She stopped on the threshold and stared at them. The fading, muddy, purple twilight barely exposed her, and the light from the kitchen silhouetted her but did not reveal any details of her face. Whether it was a trick of the strange illumination or an accurate revelation of her form, Bobby could not know, but when starkly outlined, she presented a powerfully erotic picture, sylph-like, gracefully thin yet clearly and lushly feminine, a smoky phantom that seemed either thinly clad or nude, and that issued a call of desire without making a sound. There was a powerful lubricity in this mysterious woman that made her the equal of any siren that had ever induced sailors to run their ships into hull gouging rocks.
"My sister, Violet,"
Frank said with obvious dread and disgust. Bobby noticed movement around her feet, a swarming of shadows. They poured down the steps onto the lawn, and he saw they were cats. Their eyes were iridescent in the gloom. He was gripping Frank every bit as hard as Frank was gripping him. For now, he feared release as much as he had previously feared continued captivity.
"Frank, get us out of here."
"I can't. I don't have control of this. Of myself."
There were a dozen cats. 2 dozen. Still more. As they rushed off the porch and across the first few yards of unmown grass, they were silent. Then, simultaneously, they cried out, as if they were a single creature. Their wail of anger and hunger instantly cured Bobby of his nausea and made his stomach quiver instead with terror.
"Frank!"
He wished he hadn't taken off his shoulder holster back at the office. His gun was back there on Julie's desk, of no use to him. But as he glimpsed the bared teeth of the oncoming horde, he figured the revolver wouldn't stop them anyway. At least not enough of them. The nearest of the cats leaped.
Julie was standing by her office chair, where it had been moved into the center of the room for the session of hypnotic therapy. She was unable to step away from it because she had last seen Bobby when he had been next to that chair, and it was where she felt closest to him. "How long now?" Clint was standing at her side. He looked at his watch. Less than 6 minutes. Jackie Jacks was in the bathroom, splashing his face with cold water. Still on the sofa, with a sheaf of printouts, Lee Chen was not as relaxed as he had been 6.5 minutes ago. His Zen calm had been shattered. He was holding those papers in both hands, as if afraid they would vanish from his grasp, and his eyes were as wide now as they had been the moment that Bobby and Frank disappeared. Julie was light-headed with fear, but she was determined not to lose control of herself. Though there seemed to be nothing that she could do to help Bobby, an opportunity for action might arise when she least expected it, and she wanted to be calm and ready. Last night, Hal said that Frank returned the first time about 18 minutes after he'd left. Clint nodded. Then we've 12 minutes to go. After his second disappearance, he didn't return for hours. Listen, Clint said. If they don't show up here again in 12 minutes or an hour or 3 hours, that doesn't mean anything terrible has happened to Bobby. It's not going to be the same every time. I know. What I'm more worried about is the damn bed railing. Clint said nothing. Unable to keep her voice even, she said, Frank never did bring it back. What happened to it? He'll bring Bobby back, Clint said. He won't let Bobby out there, wherever he goes. She wished she felt confident about that.
Darkness. Fireflies. Velocity. Rain poured straight down in warm torrents, as if Bobby and Frank had materialized under a waterfall. It pasted their clothes to them in an instant. There was no wind whatsoever, as if the tremendous weight and ferocity of the rainfall had drowned the wind as it would a fire. The air was steamy, humid. They had traveled far enough around the globe to have left twilight behind. The sun was up there somewhere behind the steely plating of gray clouds. They were on their sides this time, facing each other like two inebriates who had been arm-wrestling and had fallen drunkenly off their stools onto the floor of the barroom, where they still lay with their hands locked in competition. They were not in a bar, however, but in lush tropical foliage, ferns, dark green plants with rubbery, deeply crenulated foliage, ground-hugging succulent vines with leaves as plump as gum candies and berries the same shade as the flesh of a mandarin orange. Bobby pulled away from Frank, and this time his client let him go without a struggle. He scrambled to his feet and pushed through the slick, spongy, clinging flora. He didn't know where he was going and didn't care. He just had to put a little space between himself and Frank, distance himself from the danger that Frank now represented to him. He was overwhelmed by what had happened, overloaded with new experiences that he needed to consider and to which he had to adapt before he could go on. Within half a dozen steps, he broke out of the tropical brush and onto a dark, expansive land, the nature of which at first eluded him. The rain came down not in droplets and not in sheets, but in roaring, silver-gray cascades that dramatically reduced visibility. It swept his hair over his eyes, too, which didn't help. He supposed some people, sitting by windows in dry rooms, might even have seen beauty in the storm. But there was just too damned much rain, a flood. It met the earth and the greenery with a cacophonous roar that threatened to deafen him. The rain not only exhausted him, but made him wildly and irrationally angry, as if he was being pelted not by rain, but by spittle, great gobs of phlegmy spit, and as if the roar was actually the combined voices of thousands of onlookers showering him with insults and other abuse. He stumbled forward through the peculiarly mushy soil, not muddy, but mushy, looking for someone to blame for the rain, someone to shout at and shake and maybe even punch. In 6 or 8 steps, however, he saw the breakers rolling ashore in a tumult of white foam, and he knew he was standing on a black sand beach. That realization stopped him cold. "Frank!" he shouted. And when he turned to look back the way he had come, he saw that Frank was following him a few steps behind, and round-backed, as if he were an old man unable to stand up to the force of the rain, or as if his spine had been warped by all the moisture. "Frank, damn it, where are we?" Frank stopped, unbent his back slightly, lifted his head and blinked stupidly. "What?" Raising his voice even further, Bobby shouted above the tumult, "Where are we?" Pointing to Bobby's left, Frank indicated an enigmatic, rain-shrouded structure that stood like the ancient shrine of a long-dead religion, perhaps 100 feet farther down the black beach. "Lifeguard station!" He pointed the other direction up the beach, indicating a large wooden building considerably farther from them, but less mysterious because its size made it easier to see. "Restaurant. One of the most popular on the island." "What island?" "The Big Island." "What Big Island?"
Hawaii. We're standing on Punalo Beach. This is where Clint was supposed to take me. He laughed, but it was a strange wild laugh that spooked him, so he stopped. Frank said, "The house I bought and abandoned is back there." He indicated the direction from which they had come. "Overlooking the golf course, I love the place. I was happy there for 8 months. Then he found me. Bobby, we have to get out of here." Frank took a few steps toward Bobby, out of the mushy area and onto that section of the beach where the sand was better compacted. "That's far enough," Bobby ordered when Frank was 6 or 8 feet from him. "Don't come any closer." "Bobby, we have to go now, right away. I can't teleport exactly when I want. That'll happen when it happens, but at least we have to get away from this part of the island. He knows I lived here. He's familiar with this area, and he may be following us." The fiery anger in Bobby was not quenched by the rain. It grew hotter than ever. "You lying bastard." "It's true, really," Frank said, obviously surprised by Bobby's vehemence. They were close enough to converse without shouting now, but Frank still spoke louder than usual to be heard over the crackle, hiss, patter, rumble of the deluge. "Candy came here after me, and he was worse than I'd ever seen him, more horrible, more evil. He came into my house with a baby, an infant he'd picked up somewhere only months old. He'd probably killed its parents. He bit into that poor baby's throat, Bobby, then laughed and offered me its blood, taunted me with it. He drinks blood, you know. She taught him to drink blood, and he relishes it now, thrives on it. And when I wouldn't join him at the baby's throat, he threw it aside the way you'd discard an empty beer can, and he came for me, but I traveled."
"I didn't mean you were lying about him." A wave broke closer to shore than the others, washing around Bobby's feet and leaving short-lived lace-like traceries of foam on the black sand. "I mean you lied to us about your amnesia. You remember everything. You know exactly who you are."
"No, no." Frank shook his head and made negating gestures with his hands. "I didn't know. It was a blank, and maybe it'll be a blank again when I stop traveling and stay put someplace."
"Lying shit," Bobby said.
He stooped, scooped up handsful of wet black sand, and threw it at Frank in a blind fury. Two more sopping handsful, then two more. He began to realize that he was behaving like a child throwing a tantrum. Frank flinched from the wet sand, but waited patiently for Bobby to stop.
"This isn't like you,"
he said when at last Bobby relented.
"To hell with you.
Your rage is all out of proportion to anything you imagine I've done to you."
Bobby knew that was true. As he wiped his wet, sand-covered hands on his shirt and tried to catch his breath, he began to understand that he was not angry at Frank, but at what Frank represented to him. Chaos. Teleportation was a funhouse ride in which the monsters and dangers were not illusory, but in which the constant threat of death was to be taken seriously, in which there were no rules, no verities that could be relied upon, where up was down and in was out. Chaos. They had ridden the back of a bull named Chaos, and Bobby had been flat out terrified.
"You okay?"
Frank asked. Bobby nodded. More than fear was involved, on a deeper level than intellect or even instinct, perhaps as deep as the soul itself. Bobby had been offended by that chaos. Until now, he had not realized what a powerful need he had for stability and order. He'd always thought of himself as a free spirit who thrived on change and the unexpected. But now he saw that he had limits, and that, in fact, beneath the devil-may-care attitude he sometimes struck, beat the steady heart of a stability-loving traditionalist. He suddenly understood that his passion for swing music had roots of which he'd never been aware. The elegant and complex rhythms and melodies of big band jazz appealed to his bebop surface and to the secret seeker of order who dwelt in his heart.
No wonder he liked Disney cartoons in which Donald Duck might run wild and Mickey might get in a tangled mess with Pluto, but in which order triumphed in the end. Not for him, the chaotic universe of Warner Brothers' Looney Tunes, in which reason and logic seldom won more than a temporary victory. "Sorry, Frank," he said at last. "Give me a second. This sure isn't the place for it, but I'm having an epiphany." "Listen, Bobby, please. I'm telling the truth. Evidently, I can remember everything when I travel. The very fact of traveling tears down the wall blocking my memory, but as soon as I stop traveling, the wall goes up again. It's part of the degeneration I'm undergoing, I guess. Or maybe it's just a desperate need to forget what's happened to me in the past, what's happening now, and what will sure as hell happen to me in the days to come." Though no wind had risen, some of the breakers were larger now, washing deep onto the beach. They battered the backs of Bobby's legs and, on retreating, buried his feet in coaly sand. Struggling to explain himself, Frank said, "See, traveling isn't easy for me like it is for Candy. He can control where he wants to go and when. He can travel just by deciding to do it, virtually by wishing himself someplace, like you suggested I might be able to do, but I can't. My talent for teleportation isn't really a talent. It's a curse." His voice grew shaky. I didn't even know I could do it until 7 years ago, the day that bitch died. All of us who came from her womb are cursed. We can't escape it. I thought I could escape somehow by killing her, but that didn't release me." After the events of the past hour, Bobby thought nothing could surprise him. But he was startled by the confession Frank had made. This pathetic, sad-eyed, dimpled, comic-faced, pudgy man seemed an unlikely perpetrator of matricide. "You killed your own mother?"
"Never mind about her. We haven't time for her."
Frank looked back toward the brush out of which they had come and both ways along the beach, but they were still alone in the downpour.
"If you'd known her, if you'd suffered under her hand," Frank said, his voice shaking with anger, "if you'd known the atrocity she's capable of, you'd have picked up an axe and chopped at her, too."
"You took an axe and gave your mother 40 whacks?" That crazy sound burst from Bobby again, a laugh as wet as the rain, but not as warm, and again he was spooked by himself.
"I discovered I could teleport when Candy had me backed into a corner going to kill me for having killed her. And that's the only time I can travel, when it's a matter of survival."
"Nobody was threatening me last night in the hospital."
"Well, see, when I start traveling in my sleep, I think maybe I'm trying to escape from Candy in the dream, which triggers teleportation. Traveling always wakes me, but then I can't stop. I keep popping from place to place, sometimes staying a few seconds, sometimes an hour or more, and it's beyond my control, like I'm being bounced around inside a goddamn cosmic pinball machine. It exhausts me. It's killing me. You can see how it's killing me."
Frank's earnest persistence and the numbing, relentless roar of the rain had washed away Bobby's rage. He was still somewhat afraid of Frank, of the potential for chaos that Frank represented, but he was no longer angry.
"Years ago," Frank said, "years ago, dreams started me traveling maybe one night a month, but gradually the frequency increased until the last few weeks it happens almost every time I go to sleep. And when we finally wind up in your office or wherever this episode is going to come to an end, you'll remember everything that's happened to us, but I won't. Not only because I want to forget, but because what you suspected is true. I'm not always putting myself back together without mistakes."
"Your mental confusion, loss of intellectual skills, amnesia, they're symptoms of those mistakes?"
"Yeah. I'm sure there's sloppy reconstruction and cell damage every time I travel. Nothing dramatic in any one trip, but the effect is incremental and accelerating. Sooner or later, it's going to go critical, and I'll either die or experience some weird biological meltdown. Coming to you for help was pointless, no matter how good you are at what you do, because nobody can help me. Nobody.
Bobby had already reached that conclusion, but he was still curious. What is it with your family, Frank? Your brother has the power to make the car disintegrate around you, the power to blow out those street lamps and he can teleport, and what was that business with the cats?
My sisters, the twins, they have this thing with animals.
How come all of you possess these abilities?
Who was your mother? Your father?
We don't have time for that now, Bobby. Later. I'll try to explain later. He held out his cut hand, which had either stopped bleeding or was sluiced free of blood by the rain.
I could pop out of here any moment, and you'd be stranded.
No thanks, Bobby said, shunning his client's hand. Call me an old fuddy-duddy, but I'd prefer an airliner. He patted his hip pocket. Got my wallet, credit cards. I can be back in Orange County tomorrow. I don't have to take a chance that I'll arrive there with my left ear where my nose should be.
But Candy's probably going to follow us, Bobby. If you're here when he shows up, he'll kill you.
Bobby turned to his right and started to walk toward the distant restaurant. I'm not afraid of anyone named Candy.
You better be,
Frank said, grabbing his arm and halting him. Jerking away as if making contact with his client was tantamount to contracting the bubonic plague, Bobby said. How could he follow us anyway? When Frank worriedly surveyed the beach again, Bobby realized that because of the pounding rain and the underlying crash of the surf, they might not hear the telltale, flute-like sounds that would warn them of Candy's imminent arrival. Frank said,
Sometimes, when he touches something you recently touched, he sees an image of you in his mind. And sometimes he can see where you went after you put the object down, and he can follow you.
But I didn't touch anything back there at the house.
You stood on the back lawn.
So?
If he can find the place where the grass is trampled, find where we stood, he might be able to put his fingers to the grass and see us, see this place, and come after us.
For God's sake, Frank, you make this guy sound supernatural.
He's the next thing to it.
Bobby almost said he would take his chances with Brother Candy, regardless of his godlike powers. Then he remembered what the Fonz had told him about the savage murders of the Ferris family. He also remembered the Roman family, their brutalized bodies torched to cover the ragged gashes that Candy's teeth had torn in their throats. He recalled what Frank had said about Candy offering him the fresh blood of a living baby, factored in the unmitigated terror in Frank's eyes at that very moment, and thought of the inexplicable prophetic dream he'd had about the bad thing. At last he said, All right, okay, if he shows up and if you're able to pop out of here before he kills us both, then I'd be better off with you. I'll take your hand, but only until we walk up to that restaurant, call a cab, and are on our way to the airport. He gripped Frank's hand reluctantly. As soon as we're out of this area, I let go.
All right, good enough, Frank said.
Squinting as the rain battered their faces, they headed toward the restaurant. The structure, which stood perhaps 150 yards away, appeared to be made of gray, weathered wood and lots of glass. Bobby thought he saw dim lights in the place, but he could not be sure. The large windows were no doubt tinted, which filtered out what fraction of the lamp glow was not already hidden by the veils of rain. Every third or fourth incoming wave was now much larger than the others, reached farther onto the beach, and sloshed around their legs with enough force to unbalance them. They moved toward the higher end of the strand, away from the breakers, but the sand was far softer there. It sucked at their shoes and made progress more laborious. Bobby thought of Lisa, the blonde receptionist at Palomar Labs. He pictured her coming along the beach right now, taking the crazy romantic walk in the warm rain with some guy who'd brought her to the islands. Pictured her face when she saw him strolling the black sand beach hand in hand with another man, cheating on Clint. This time, his laughter